That sea smell was all at once too thick, much too thick. It was everywhere, and the water dripping from the wet branches of the trees seemed much too loud. Something was coming. He heard dragging, lurching footsteps in the grass. He stood on the pedals, giving it everything, and shot out onto Main Street without looking back. He headed for home as fast as he could, wondering what in hell had possessed him to come in the first place. What had drawn him? And then he tried to think about the chores, the whole chores, and nothing but the chores. After a while, he actually succeeded. And when he saw the headline in the paper the next day, "Missing Boy Prompts New Fears," he thought about the pocket knife he had thrown into the canal, the pocket knife with the initials EC scratched on the side. He thought about the blood he had seen on the grass, and he thought about those grooves which stopped at the edge of the canal. Chapter 7. The Dam in the Barrens. 1. Seen from the expressway at 4:45 in the morning, Boston seems a city of the dead brooding over some tragedy in its past. A plague, perhaps, or a curse. The smell of salt, heavy and cloying, comes off the ocean. Runners of early morning fog obscure much of what movement would be seen otherwise. Driving north along Storo Drive, sitting behind the wheel of the black 84 Cadillac he picked up from Butch Carrington at Cape Cod Limousine, Eddie Kasprak thinks you can feel this city's age. Perhaps you can get that feeling of age nowhere else in America but here. Boston is a sprat compared with London, an infant compared with Rome, but by American standards, at least, it is old, old. It kept its place on these low hills 300 years ago when the tea and stamp taxes were unthought of, Paul Revere and Patrick Henry unborn. Its age, its silence, and the foggy smell of the sea, all these things make Eddie nervous. When Eddie's nervous, he reaches for his aspirator. He sticks it in his mouth and triggers a cloud of revivifying spray down his throat. There are a few people in the streets he's passing, and a pedestrian or two on the walkways of the overpasses. They give lie to the impression that he has somehow wandered into a Lovecrafty tale of doomed cities, ancient evils, and monsters with unpronounceable names. Here, ganged around a bus stop with a sign reading Kenmore Square, City Center, he sees waitresses, nurses, city employees, their faces naked and puffed with sleep. That's right, Eddie thinks, now passing under a sign which reads Tobin Bridge. That's right. Stick to the buses. Forget the subways. The subways are a bad idea. I wouldn't go down there if I were you. Not down below, not in the tunnels. This is a bad thought to have. If he doesn't get rid of it, he will soon be using the aspirator again. He's glad for the heavier traffic on the Tobin Bridge. He passes a monument works. Painted on the brick side is a slightly unsettling admonishment. Slow down, we can wait. Here is a green reflectorized sign which reads, "To 95, Maine, New Hampshire, all northern New England points." He looks at it and suddenly a bone-deep shudder racks his body. His hands momentarily weld themselves to the wheel of the Cadillac. He would like to believe it is the onset of some sickness, a virus or perhaps one of his mother's phantom fevers, but he knows better. It is the city behind him, poised silently on the straight edge that runs between day and night, and what that sign promises ahead of him. He's sick all right, no doubt about that, but it's not a virus or a phantom fever. He has been poisoned by his own memories. I'm scared, Eddie thinks. That was always what was at the bottom of it. Just being scared, that was everything. But in the end, I think we turned that around somehow. We used it. But how? He can't remember. He wonders if any of the others can. For all their sakes, he certainly hopes so. A truck drones by on his left. Eddie has still got his lights on, and now he hits his brights momentarily as the truck draws safely ahead. He does this without thinking. It has become an automatic function, just part of driving for a living. The unseen driver in the truck flashes his running lights in return, quickly twice, thanking Eddie for his courtesy. If only everything could be that simple and that clear, he thinks. He follows the signs to I-95. The northbound traffic is light, although he observes that the southbound lanes into the city are starting to fill up, even at this early hour. Eddie floats the big car along, pre-guessing most of the directional signs and getting into the correct lane long before he has to. It has been years, literally years, since he has guessed wrong enough to be swept past an exit he wanted. He makes his lane choices as automatically as he flashed OK to cut back in to the trucker, as automatically as he once found his way through the tangle of paths in the Dairy Barrens. The fact that he has never before in his life driven out of downtown Boston, one of the most confusing cities in America to drive in, does not seem to matter much at all. He suddenly remembers something else about that summer, something Bill said to him one day. "You've got a humpus in your head, Eddie." How that had pleased him. It pleases him again as the 84 Dorado shoots back onto the turnpike. He slides the limo's speed up to a cop-safe 57 miles an hour and finds some quiet music on the radio. He supposes he would have died for Bill back then, if that had been required. If Bill had asked him, Eddie would simply have responded, "Sure, Big Bill. You got a time in mind yet?" Eddie laughs at this. Not much of a sound, just a snort, but the sound of it startles him into a real laugh. He laughs seldom these days, and he certainly did not expect to find many chucks, Richie's word meaning chuckles, as in, "You had any good chucks today, Eds?" on this black pilgrimage. But he supposes, if God is dirty mean enough to curse the faithful with what they want most in life, he's maybe quirky enough to deal you a good chuck or two along the way. "Had any good chucks lately, Eds?" he says out loud and laughs again. Man, he had hated it when Richie called him Eds. But he had sort of liked it, too. The way he thought Ben Hanscom got to like Richie calling him Haystack. It was something like a secret name. A secret identity. A way to be people that had nothing to do with their parents' fears, hopes, constant demands. Richie couldn't do his beloved voices for shit. But maybe he did know how important it was for creeps like them to sometimes be different people. Eddie glances at the change lined up neatly on the Dorado's dashboard. Lining up the change is another of those automatic tricks of the trade. When the toll booths come up, you never want to have to dig for your silver, never want to find that you've gotten in an automatic toll lane with the wrong change. Among the coins are two or three Susan B. Anthony silver dollars. They are coins, he reflects, that you probably only find in the pockets of chauffeurs and taxi drivers from the New York area these days. Just as the only place you are apt to see a lot of $2 bills is at a racetrack payoff window. He always keeps a few on hand because the robot toll-taker baskets on the George Washington and the Triborough bridges take them. Another of those lights suddenly comes on in his head. Silver dollars. Not these fake copper sandwiches, but real silver dollars, with Lady Liberty dressed in her gauzy robe stamped upon them. Ben Hanscom's silver dollars. Yes, but wasn't it Bill or Ben or Beverly who once used one of those silver cartwheels to save their lives? He is not quite sure of this, is, in fact, not quite sure of anything. Or is it just that he doesn't want to remember? It was dark in there, he thinks suddenly. I remember that much. It was dark in there. Boston is well behind him now, and the fog is starting to burn off. Ahead is Maine, New Hampshire, all northern New England points. Derry is ahead, and there is something in Derry which should be 27 years dead and yet is somehow not. Something with as many faces as Lon Chaney. But what is it really? Didn't they see it at the end as it really was, with all its masks cast aside? Ah, he can remember so much, but not enough. He remembers that he loved Bill Denbrough. He remembers that well enough. Bill never made fun of his asthma. Bill never called him little sissy queer boy. He loved Bill like he would have loved a big brother or a father. Bill knew stuff to do, places to go, things to see. Bill was never up against it. When you ran with Bill, you ran to beat the devil and you laughed. But you hardly ever ran out of breath. And hardly ever running out of breath was great, so fucking great that he would tell the world. When you ran with Big Bill, you got your chucks every day. "Sure, kid, every day," he says in a Richie Tozier voice and laughs again. It had been Bill's idea to make the dam in the Barrens, and it was, in a way, the dam that had brought them all together. Ben Hanscom had been the one to show them how the dam could be built, and they had built it so well that they'd gotten in a lot of trouble with Mr. Nell, the cop on the beat. But it had been Bill's idea. And although all of them except Richie had seen very odd things, frightening things, in Derry since the turn of the year, it had been Bill who had first found the courage to say something out loud. That dam. That damn dam. He remembered Victor Chris. Ta-ta, boys. It was a real baby dam, believe me. You're better off without it. A day later, Ben Hanscom was grinning at them, saying, "We could. We could flood. We could flood out the... two. Whole barrens if we wanted to." Bill and Eddie looked at Ben doubtfully, and then at the stuff Ben had brought along with him. Some boards, scrounged from Mr. McKibben's backyard, but that was okay, since Mr. McKibben had probably scavenged them from someone else's. A sledgehammer, a shovel. "I don't know," Eddie said, glancing at Bill. "When we tried yesterday, it didn't work very good. The current kept washing our sticks away." "This'll work," Ben said. He also looked to Bill for the final decision. "Well, let's give it a try," Bill said. "I could call Richie Tozier this morning. He's gonna be over later," he said. "Maybe him and Hanley will want to help."
"Stanley who?"
Ben asked. "Urus," Eddie said. He was still looking cautiously at Bill, who seemed somehow different today. Quieter, less enthusiastic about the idea of the dam. Bill looked pale today, distant.
"Stanley Urus. I guess I don't know him. Does he go to Derry Elementary?"
"He's our age, but he just finished the fourth grade," Eddie said. "He started school a year late because he was sick a lot when he was a little kid." "You think you took Chong yesterday. You just ought to be glad you're not Stan. Someone's always racking Stan to the dogs and back."
"He's Jewish," Bill said.
Lots of kids don't hike him because he's Jewish."
"Oh, yeah?" Ben asked, impressed. "Jewish, huh?"
He paused and then said carefully,
"Is that like being Turkish? Or is it more like, you know, Egyptian?"
"I could guess it's more like Turkish," Bill said.
He picked up one of the boards Ben had brought and looked at it. It was about 6 feet long and 3 feet wide.
"My dad says most Jews have big noses and lots of money, but
But Stan's got a regular nose and he's always broke," Eddie said.
"Yeah,"
Bill said, and broke into a real grin for the first time that day. Ben grinned, Eddie grinned. Bill tossed the board aside, got up, and brushed off the seat of his jeans. He walked to the edge of the stream, and the other two boys joined him. Bill shoved his hands in his back pockets and sighed deeply. Eddie was sure Bill was going to say something serious. He looked from Eddie to Ben and then back to Eddie again, not smiling now. Eddie was suddenly afraid. But all Bill said then was,
"You got your aspirator, Eddie?"
Eddie slapped his pocket. "I'm loaded for bear."
"Say, how'd it work with the chocolate milk?" Ben asked.
Eddie laughed. "Worked great," he said. He and Ben broke up while Bill looked at them, smiling but puzzled. Eddie explained, and Bill nodded, grinning again.
"Eddie's mom is worried that he's gonna break, and she won't be able to get a refund.
Eddie snorted and made as if to push him into the stream.
"Watch it, fuckface," Bill said, sounding uncannily like Henry Bowers. "I'll twist your head so far around you'll be able to watch when you wipe yourself."
Ben collapsed, shrieking with laughter. Bill glanced at him, still smiling, hands still in the back pockets of his jeans, smiling. Yeah, but a little distant again, a little vague. He looked at Eddie and then cocked his head toward Ben.
"Kid's soft," he said.
"Yeah," Eddie agreed, but he felt somehow that they were only going through the motions of having a good time. Something was on Bill's mind. He supposed Bill would spill it when he was ready. The question was, did Eddie want to hear what it was?
"Kid's mentally retarded."
"Retreaded," Ben said, still giggling. "You gonna show us how to build a dam, or are you gonna hit there on your big can all the day?"
Ben got to his feet again. He looked first at the stream, flowing past them at moderate speed. The Kandusky was not terribly wide this far up in the barrens, but it had defeated them yesterday just the same. Neither Eddie nor Bill had been able to figure out how to get a foothold on the current. But Ben was smiling, the smile of one who contemplates doing something new, something that will be fun but not very hard.
Eddie thought, he knows how. I really think he does.
Okay, he said. You guys want to take your shoes off because you're going to get your little footsies wet.
The mind mother in Eddie's head spoke up at once, her voice as stern and commanding as the voice of a traffic cop.
Don't you dare do it, Eddie. Don't you dare. Wet feet, that's one way, one of the thousands of ways that colds start, and colds lead to pneumonia, so don't you do it.
Bill and Ben were sitting on the bank, pulling off their sneakers and socks. Ben was fussily rolling up the legs of his jeans. Bill looked up at Eddie. His eyes were clear and warm, sympathetic. Eddie was suddenly sure Big Bill knew exactly what he had been thinking, and he was ashamed.
You coming?
Yeah, sure, Eddie said.
He sat down on the bank and undressed his feet while his mother ranted inside his head, but her voice was growing steadily more distant and echoey. He was relieved to note, as if someone had stuck a heavy fishhook through the back of her blouse and was now reeling her away from him down a very long corridor.
3.
It was one of those perfect summer days which, in a world where everything was on track and on the beam, you would never forget. A moderate breeze kept the worst of the mosquitoes and black flies away. The sky was a bright, crisp blue. Temperatures were in the low 70s. Birds sang and went about their birdie business in the bushes and second-growth trees. Eddie had to use his aspirator once, and then his chest lightened and his throat seemed to widen magically to the size of a freeway. He spent the rest of the morning with it stuffed forgotten into his back pocket. Ben Hanscom, who had seemed so timid and unsure the day before, became a confident general once he was fully involved in the actual construction of the dam. Every now and then he would climb the bank and stand there with his muddy hands on his hips, looking at the work in progress and muttering to himself. Sometimes he would run a hand through his hair, and by 11 o'clock it was standing up in crazy comical spikes. Eddie felt uncertainty at first, then a sense of glee, and finally an entirely new feeling, one that was at the same time weird, terrifying, and exhilarating. It was a feeling so alien to his usual state of being that he was not able to put a name to it until that night, lying in bed and looking at the ceiling and replaying the day.
Power.
That was what that feeling had been. Power. It was going to work, by God, and it was going to work better than he and Bill, maybe even Ben himself, had dreamed it could. He could see Bill getting involved, too, only a little at first, still mulling over whatever it was he had on his mind, and then, bit by bit, committing himself fully. Once or twice he clapped Ben on one meaty shoulder and told him he was unbelievable. Ben flushed with pleasure each time. Ben got Eddie and Bill to set one of the boards across the stream and hold it as he used the sledgehammer to seat it in the stream bed.
There, it's in. But you'll have to hold it or the current'll just pull it loose, he told Eddie.
So Eddie stood in the middle of the stream holding the board while water sluiced over its top and made his hands into wavering starfish shapes. Ben and Bill located a second board 2 feet downstream of the first. Ben used the sledge again to seat it, and Bill held it while Ben began to fill up the space between the two boards with sandy earth from the stream bank. At first it only washed away around the ends of the boards in gritty clouds, and Eddie didn't think it was going to work at all. But when Ben began adding rocks and muddy gook from the stream bed, the clouds of escaping silt began to diminish. In less than 20 minutes, he had created a heaped brown canal of earth and stones between the two boards in the middle of the stream. To Eddie, it looked like an optical illusion.
If we had real cement instead of just mud and rocks, they'd have to move the whole city over to the old Cape side by the middle of next week,
Ben said, slinging the shovel aside at last and sitting on the bank until he got his breath back. Bill and Eddie laughed, and Ben grinned at them. When he grinned, there was a ghost of the handsome man he would become in the lines of his face. Water had begun to pile up behind the upstream board now. Eddie asked what they were going to do about the water escaping around the sides.
Let it go. It doesn't matter.
It doesn't?
Nope.
Why not?
I can't explain exactly. You gotta let some out, though.
How do you know?
Ben shrugged.
I just do,
the shrug said, and Eddie was silenced. When he was rested, Ben got a third board, the thickest of the 4 or 5 he had carried laboriously across town to the Barrens,
and placed it carefully against the downstream board, wedging one end firmly into the stream bed and socking the other against the board Bill had been holding, creating the strut he had put in his little drawing the day before.
Okay, he said, standing back. He grinned at them. You guys should be able to let go now.
The gook in between the two boards will take most of the water pressure. The strut will take the rest.
Won't the water wash it away? Eddie asked.
Nope, the water is just going to push it in deeper.
And if you're wrong, we could get to kill you, Bill said.
That's cool, Ben said amiably. Bill and Eddie stepped back. The two boards that formed the basis of the dam creaked a little, tilted a little, and that was all.
Hot shit, Eddie screamed, excited.
It's great, Bill said, grinning.
Yeah, Ben said. Let's eat.
4. They sat on the bank and ate, not talking much, watching the water stack up behind the dam and sluice around the ends of the boards. They had already done something to the geography of the stream banks, Eddie saw. The diverted current was cutting scalloped hollows into them. As he watched, the new course of the stream undercut the bank enough on the far side to cause a small avalanche. Upstream of the dam, the water formed a roughly circular pool, and at one place it had actually overflowed the bank. Bright reflecting rills ran off into the grass and the underbrush. Eddie slowly began to realize what Ben had known from the first. The dam was already built. The gaps between the boards and the banks were sluiceways. Ben had not been able to tell Eddie this because he did not know the word. Above the boards, the Kanduskeag had taken on a swelled look. The chuckling sound of shallow water babbling its way over stones and gravel was now gone. All the stones upstream of the dam were underwater. Every now and then, more sod and dirt, undercut by the widening stream, would fall into the water with a splash. Downstream of the dam, the water course was nearly empty. Thin trickles ran restlessly down its center, but that was about all. Stones which had been underwater for God knew how long were drying in the sun. Eddie looked at these drying stones with mild wonder and that weird other feeling. They had done this. They. He saw a frog hopping along and thought maybe old Mr. Froggy was wondering just where the water had gone. Eddie laughed out loud. Ben was neatly stowing his empty wrappers in the lunch bag he had brought. Both Eddie and Bill had been amazed by the size of the repast Ben had laid out with businesslike efficiency. 2 PB&J sandwiches, 1 bologna sandwich, a hard-cooked egg, complete with a pinch of salt twisted up in a small piece of waxed paper, 2 fig bars, 3 large chocolate chip cookies, and a ring-ding.
What did your ma say when she saw how bad you got racked? Eddie asked him.
Hmm?
Ben looked up from the spreading pool of water behind the dam and belched gently against the back of his hand.
Oh, well, I knew she'd be grocery shopping yesterday afternoon, so I was able to beat her home. I took a bath and washed my hair. Then I threw away the jeans and the sweatshirt I was wearing. I don't know if she'll notice they're gone or not. Probably not the sweatshirt. I got lots of sweatshirts. But I guess I ought to buy myself a new pair of jeans before she gets nosing through my drawers.
The thought of wasting his money on such a non-essential item cast momentary gloom across Ben's face.
Well, what about the way you were bruised up?
I told her I was so excited to be out of school that I ran out the door and fell down the steps, Ben said, and looked both amazed and a little hurt when Eddie and Bill began laughing.
Bill, who had been chowing up a piece of his mother's devil's food cake, blew out a brown jet of crumbs and then had a coughing fit. Eddie, still howling, clapped him on the back.
Well, I almost did fall down the steps, Ben said. Only it was because Victor Crisp pushed me, not because I was running.
I'd be as hot as tamale in a head shirt like that, Bill said, finishing the last bite of his cake.
Ben hesitated. For a moment, it seemed he would say nothing.
It's better when you're fat, he said finally. Sweatshirts, I mean.
Because of your gut? Eddie asked.
Bill snorted.
Because of your Yeah, my tits. So what?
Yeah, Bill said mildly.
So what?
There was a moment of awkward silence, and then Eddie said,
Look how dark the water's getting when it goes around that side of the dam.
Oh, cripes,
Ben shot to his feet. Current's pulling out the fill. Geez, I wish we had cement. The damage was quickly repaired, but even Eddie could see what would happen without someone there to almost constantly shovel in fresh fill.
Erosion would eventually cause the upstream board to collapse against the downstream board, and then everything would fall over.
We can shore up the sides, Ben said. That won't stop the erosion, but it'll slow it down.
If we use sand and mud, won't it just go on washing away? Eddie asked.
We'll use chunks of sod.
Bill nodded, smiled, and made an O with the thumb and forefinger of his right hand.
Let's dig a go. I'll dig 'em, and you should show me where to put 'em in, Big Ben.
From behind him, a stridently cheery voice called,
My God! Someone put the Y pool down in the Barrens, belly button, lint, and all.
Eddie turned, noticing the way Ben tightened up at the sound of a strange voice, the way his lips thinned. Standing above them and a ways upstream on the path Ben had crossed the day before were Richie Tozier and Stanley Uris. Richie came bopping down to the stream, glanced at Ben with some interest, and then pinched Eddie's cheek.
Don't do that. I hate it when you do that, Richie.
Ah, you love it, Eds, Richie said and beamed at him. So what do you say? You having any good chucks or what?
5. The five of them knocked off around 4 o'clock. They sat much higher on the bank. The place where Bill, Ben, and Eddie had eaten lunch was now underwater, and stared down at their handiwork. Even Ben found it a little difficult to believe. He felt a sense of tired accomplishment, which was mixed with uneasy fright. He found himself thinking of Fantasia and how Mickey Mouse had known enough to get the broom started, but not enough to make them stop.
Fucking incredible, Richie Tozier said softly and pushed his glasses up on his nose.
Eddie glanced over at him, but Richie was not doing one of his numbers now. His face was thoughtful, almost solemn. On the far side of the stream, where the land first rose and then tilted shallowly downhill, they had created a new piece of bogland. Bracken and holly bushes stood in a foot of water. Even as they sat here, they could see the bog sending out fresh pseudopods, spreading steadily westward. Behind the dam, the Kanduskeag, shallow and harmless just this morning, had become a still swollen band of water. By 2 o'clock, the widening pool behind the dam had taken so much embankment that the spillways had grown almost to the size of rivers themselves. Everyone but Ben had gone on an emergency expedition to the dump in search of more materials. Ben stuck around, methodically sodding up leaks. The scavengers had returned not only with boards, but with 4 bald tires, the rusty door of a 1949 Hudson Hornet, and a big piece of corrugated steel siding. Under Ben's leadership, they had built 2 wings on the original dam, blocking off the water's escape around the sides again. And, with the wings raked back at an angle against the current, the dam worked even better than before.
Stop that sucker cold, Richie said. You're a genius, man.
Ben smiled.
It's not so much.
I got some Winstons, Richie said. Who wants one? He produced the crumpled red and white pack from his pants pocket and passed it around. Eddie, thinking of the hell a cigarette would raise with his asthma, refused. Stan also refused. Bill took one, and after a moment's thought, Ben took one, too. Richie produced a book of matches with the words Roy Tan on the outside and lit first Ben's cigarette, then Bill's. He was about to light his own when Bill blew out the match.
Thanks a lot, Denbro, you wet, Richie said.
Bill smiled apologetically.
Three on a hatch, he said. But bad little luck.
Bad luck for your folks when you were born, Richie said, and lit his cigarette with another match. He lay down and crossed his arms beneath his head. The cigarette jutted upward between his teeth.
Winston tastes good, like a cigarette should.
He turned his head slightly and winked at Eddie.
Ain't that right, Eds?
Ben, Eddie saw, was looking at Richie with a mixture of awe and wariness. Eddie could understand that. He had known Richie Tozier for 4 years, and he still didn't really understand what Richie was about. He knew that Richie got A's and B's in his schoolwork, but he also knew that Richie regularly got C's and D's in deportment. His father really racked him about it, and his mother just about cried every time Richie brought home those poor conduct grades, and Richie would swear to do better, and maybe he even would, for a quarter or two. The trouble with Richie was that he couldn't keep still for more than a minute at a time, and he couldn't keep his mouth shut at all. Down here in the Barrens, that didn't get him in much trouble, but the Barrens weren't never-never land, and they couldn't be the wild boys for more than a few hours at a stretch. The idea of a wild boy with an aspirator in his back pocket made Eddie smile. The trouble with the Barrens was that you always had to leave. Out there in the wider world, Richie's bullshit was always getting him in trouble. With adults, which was bad, and with guys like Henry Bowers, which was even worse. His entrance earlier today was a perfect example. Ben Hanscom had no more than started to say hi when Richie had fallen on his knees at Ben's feet. He then began a series of gigantic salaams, his arms outstretched, his hands flopping against the muddy bank every time he bowed again. At the same time, he had begun to speak in one of his voices. Richie had about a dozen different voices. His ambition, he had told Eddie one rainy afternoon when they were in the little raftered room over the Casbrack garage reading Little Lulu comic books, was to become the world's greatest ventriloquist. He was going to be even greater than Edgar Bergen, he said, and he would be on the Ed Sullivan Show every week. Eddie admired this ambition, but foresaw problems with it. First of all, Richie's voices sounded pretty much like Richie Tozier. This was not to say Richie could not be very funny from time to time. He could be. When referring to verbal zingers and loud farts, Richie's terminology was the same. He called it getting off a good one. And he got off good ones of both types frequently, usually in inappropriate company, however. Second, when Richie did ventriloquism, his lips moved. Not just a little on the P and B sounds, but a lot. And on all the sounds. Third, when Richie said he was going to throw his voice, it usually didn't go very far. Most of his friends were too kind, or too bemused with Richie's sometimes enchanting, often exhausting charm, to mention these little failings to him. Salaaming frantically in front of the startled and embarrassed Ben Hanscom, Richie was speaking in what he called his nigger Jim voice.
"Lawks a mussy! It's be Haystack Calhoun!" Richie screamed. "Don't fall on me, Mr. Haystack, sir. You's gwine to cream me if you do. Lawks a mussy, lawks a mussy. 300 pounds of swangin' meat, 88 inches from tit to tit. Haystack be smellin' just like a loader panther shit. I's gwine to lead yer into de rang, Mr. Haystack, sir. I show enough gwine to lead yer. Just don't you be fallin' on this yer black boy."
"Don't worry," Bill said. "It's just Richie. He's kaka crazy." Richie bounced to his feet.
"I heard that then, bro. You better leave me alone, or I'll stick Haystack here on you."
"The best part of you ran down your father's little leg," Bill said.
"True," Richie said. "But look how much good stuff was left."
"How you doing, Haystack? Richie Tozier is my name. Doing voices is my game."
He popped his hand out. Thoroughly confused, Ben reached for it. Richie pulled his hand back. Ben blinked. Relenting, Richie shook.
"My name's Ben Hanscom, in case you're interested," Ben said.
"Seen you around school," Richie said. He swept a hand at the spreading pool of water. "This must have been your idea. These wet ends couldn't light a firecracker with a flamethrower."
"Speak for yourself, Richie," Eddie said.
"Oh, you mean it was your idea, Eds? Jesus, I'm sorry." He fell down in front of Eddie and began salaaming wildly again.
"Get up, stop it. You're splattering mud on me," Eddie cried.
Richie jumped to his feet a second time and pinched Eddie's cheek.
"Cute, cute, cute," Richie exclaimed.
"Stop it. I hate that."
"Fess up, Eds. Who built the dam?"
"The bench showed us," Bill said.
"Good deal."
Richie turned and discovered Stanley Uris standing behind him, hands in his pockets, watching quietly as Richie put on his show.
"This here's Stan the Man Uris," Richie told Ben. "Stan's a Jew. Also, he killed Christ. At least that's what Victor Crist told me one day. I've been after Stan ever since. I figure if he's that old, he ought to be able to buy us some beer, right, Stan?"
"I think that must have been my father," Stan said in a low, pleasant voice, and that broke them all up, Ben included.
Eddie laughed until he was wheezing and tears were running down his face.
"A good one," Richie cried, striding around with his arms thrown up over his head like a football referee signaling that the extra point was good. "Stan the Man gets off a good one. Great moments in history. Yowza, yowza, yowza."
"Hi," Stan said to Ben, seeming to take no notice of Richie at all.
"Hello," Ben replied.
"We were in the same class in second grade. You were the kid who..."
"Never said anything," Stan finished, smiling a little.
"Right."
"Stan wouldn't say shit if he had a mouthful," Richie said, "which he frequently does. Yowza, yowza, yow."
Shut up, Richie," Bill said.
"Okay, but first I have to tell you one more thing. Much as I hate to, I think you're losing your dam. Valley's gonna flood, partners. Let's get the women and children out first."
And without bothering to roll up his pants, or even to remove his sneakers,
Richie jumped into the water and began to slam sods into place on the near side wing of the dam where the persistent current was pulling fill out in muddy streamers again. A piece of Red Cross adhesive tape was wrapped around one of the bows of his glasses, and the loose end flapped against his cheekbone as he worked. Bill caught Eddie's eye, smiled a little, and shrugged. It was just Richie. He could drive you bug shit, but it was still sort of nice to have him around. They worked on the dam for the next hour or so. Richie took Ben's commands, which had become rather tentative again, with two more kids to general, with perfect willingness, and fulfilled them at a manic pace. When each mission was completed, he reported back to Ben for further orders, executing a backhand British salute and snapping the soggy heels of his sneakers together. Every now and then, he would begin to harangue the others in one of his voices. The German commandant, Toodles the English butler, the Southern senator, who sounded quite a bit like Foghorn Leghorn, and who would, in the fullness of time, evolve into a character named Buford Kissdrivel, the movie-tone newsreel narrator. The work did not just go forward, it sprinted forward. And now, shortly before 5 o'clock, as they sat resting on the bank, it seemed that what Richie had said was true. They had stopped the sucker cold. The car door, the piece of corrugated steel, and the old tires had become the second stage of the dam, and it was backstopped by a huge sloping hill of earth and stones. Bill, Ben, and Richie smoked. Stan was lying on his back. A stranger might have thought he was just looking at the sky, but Eddie knew better. Stan was looking into the trees on the other side of the stream, keeping an eye out for a bird or two he could write up in his bird notebook that night. Eddie himself just sat cross-legged, feeling pleasantly tired and rather mellow. At that moment, the others seemed to him like the greatest bunch of guys to chum with a fellow could ever hope to have.